The Two Divorces. Chapter 9. The Trial Resumed. The trial was resumed. The Bishop of Bath and Wells waited upon the Queen at Greenwich, and peremptorily summoned her to appear in the Parliament Chamber. On the day appointed, Catherine limited herself to sending an appeal to the Pope. She was declared contumacious, and the legates proceeded with the cause. 12 articles were prepared, which were to serve for the examination of the witnesses, and the summary of which was, that the marriage of Henry with Catherine, being forbidden both by the law of God and of the Church, was null and void. The hearing of the witnesses began, and Dr. Taylor, Archdeacon of Buckingham, conducted the examination. Their evidence, which would now be taken only with closed doors, may be found in Lord Herbert of Cherbury's History of Henry VIII. The Duke of Norfolk, High Treasurer of England, the Duke of Suffolk, Maurice St. John, Gentleman Carver to Prince Arthur, the Viscount Fitzwalter and Anthony Willoughby, his cupbearers, testified to their being present on the morrow of the wedding at the breakfast of the prince, then in sound health, and reported the conversation that took place. The old Duchess of Norfolk, the Earl of Shrewsbury, and the Marquis of Dorset confirmed these declarations, which proved that Arthur and Catherine were really married. It was also called to mind that, at the time of Arthur's death, Henry was not permitted to take the title of Prince of Wales, because Catherine hoped to give an heir to the crown of England. 1978. If Arthur and Catherine were really married, said the king's counselors after these extraordinary depositions, the marriage of this princess with Henry, Arthur's brother, was forbidden by the divine law, by an express command of God contained in Leviticus, and no dispensation could permit what God had forbidden. Campeggio would never concede this argument, which limited the right of the popes. It was necessary, therefore, to abandon the divine right, which was in reality to lose the cause, and to seek in the bull of Julius II and in his famous brief, for flaws that would invalidate them both. And this the king's council did, although they did not conceal the weakness of their position. The motive alleged in the dispensation, they said, is the necessity of preserving a cordial relation between Spain and England. Now, there was nothing that threatened their harmony. Moreover, it is said in this document that the Pope grants it at the prayer of Henry, Prince of Wales. Now, as this prince was only 13 years old, he was not of age to make such a request. As for the brief, it is found neither in England nor in Rome. We cannot therefore admit its authenticity. It was not difficult for Catherine's friends to invalidate these objections. Besides, they added, a union that has lasted 20 years sufficiently establishes its own lawfulness. And will you declare the Princess Mary illegitimate, to the great injury of this realm? The king's advocates then changed their course. Was not the Roman legate provided with a decretal pronouncing the divorce, in case it should be proved that Arthur's marriage had been really consummated? Now, this fact had been proved by the depositions. This is the moment for delivering judgment, said Henry and his counselors to Campeggio. Publish the Pope's decretal. But the Pope feared the sword of Charles V, then hanging over his head, and accordingly, whenever the king advanced one step, the Romish prelate took several in an opposite direction. I will deliver judgment in 5 days, said he, and when the 5 days were expired, he bound himself to deliver it in 6. Restore peace to my troubled conscience, exclaimed Henry. The legate replied in courtly phrase. He had gained a few days' delay, and that was all he desired. Such conduct on the part of the Roman legate produced an unfavorable effect in England, and a change took place in the public mind. The first movement had been for Catherine. The second was for Henry. Clement's endless delays and Campeggio's stratagems exasperated the nation. The king's argument was simple and popular. The Pope cannot dispense with the laws of God, while the Queen, by appealing to the authority of the Roman pontiff, displeased both high and low. No precedent, said the lawyers, can justify the king's marriage with his brother's widow. There were, however, some evangelical Christians who thought Henry was troubled more by his passions than by his conscience, and they asked how it happened that a prince, who represented himself to be so disturbed by the possible transgression of a law of doubtful interpretation, could desire, after 20 years, to violate the indisputable law which forbade the divorce? On the 21st of July, the day fixed at concludendum, the cause was adjourned until the Friday following, and no one doubted that the matter would then be terminated. All prepared for this important day. The king ordered the Dukes of Norfolk and Suffolk to be present at the sitting of the court, and being himself impatient to hear the so much coveted judgment, he stole into a gallery of the parliament chamber facing the judges. The legates of the Holy See having taken their seats, the attorney general signified to them that everything necessary for the information of their conscience having been judicially laid before them, that day had been fixed for the conclusion of the trial. There was a pause. Every one, feeling the importance of this judgment, waited for it with impatience. "Either the papacy pronounces my divorce from Catherine," the king had said, "or I shall divorce myself from the papacy." That was the way Henry put the question. All eyes, and particularly the king's, were turned on the judges. Campeggio could not retreat. He must now say yes or no. For some time he was silent. He knew for certain that the queen's appeal had been admitted by Clement VII, and that the latter had concluded an alliance with the emperor. It was no longer in his power to grant the king's request. Clearly foreseeing that a no would perhaps forfeit the power of Rome in England, while a yes might put an end to the plans of religious emancipation which alarmed him so much, he could not make up his mind to say either yes or no. At last the nuncio rose slowly from his chair, and all the assembly listened with emotion to the oracular decision which for so many years the powerful king of England had sought from the Roman pontiff. "The general vacation of the harvest and vintage," he said, "being observed every year by the court of Rome, dating from tomorrow the 24th of July, the beginning of the dog days, we adjourn, to some future period, the conclusion of these pleadings." The auditors were thunderstruck. "What? Because the malaria renders the air of Rome dangerous at the end of July, and compels the Romans to close their courts, must the trial be broken off on the banks of the Thames, when its conclusion is looked for so impatiently?" The people hoped for a judicial sentence, and they were answered with a jest. It was thus Rome made sport of Christendom. Campeggio, to disarm Henry's wrath, gave utterance to some noble sentiments, but his whole line of conduct raises legitimate doubts as to his sincerity. "The queen," he said, "denies the competency of the court. I must therefore make my report to the Pope, who is the source of life and honor, and wait his sovereign orders. I have not come so far to please any man, be he king or subject. I am an old man, feeble and sickly, and fear none but the supreme judge, before whom I must soon appear. I therefore adjourn this court until the 1st of October." It was evident that this adjournment was only a formality intended to signify the definitive rejection of Henry's demand. The same custom prevails in the British legislature. The king, who from his place of concealment had heard Campeggio's speech, could scarcely control his indignation. He wanted a regular judgment. He clung to forms. He desired that his cause should pass successfully through all the windings of ecclesiastical procedure, and yet here it is wrecked upon the vacations of the Romish court. Henry was silent, however, either from prudence, or because surprise deprived him of the power of speech, and he hastily left the gallery. Norfolk, Suffolk, and the other courtiers did not follow him. The king and his ministers, the peers and the people, and even the clergy, were almost unanimous, and yet the Pope pronounced his veto. He humbled the defender of the faith to flatter the author of the sack of Rome. This was too much. The impetuous Suffolk started from his seat, struck his hand violently on the table in front of him, cast a threatening look upon the judges, and exclaimed, "By the Mass, the old saying is confirmed today, that no cardinal has ever brought good to England." "Sir, of all men in this realm," replied Wolsey, "you have the least cause to disparage cardinals, for if I, poor cardinal, had not been, you would not have a head on your shoulders." It would seem that Wolsey pacified Henry at the time of the Duke's marriage with the Princess Mary. "I cannot pronounce sentence," continued Wolsey, "without knowing the good pleasure of His Holiness." The two dukes and the other noblemen left the hall in anger and hastened to the palace. The legates, remaining with their officers, looked at each other for a few moments. At last Campeggio, who alone had remained calm during this scene of violence, arose, and the audience dispersed. Henry did not allow himself to be crushed by this blow. Rome, by her strange proceedings, aroused in him that suspicious and despotic spirit, of which he gave such tragic proofs in after years. The papacy was making sport of him. Clement and Wolsey tossed his divorce from one to the other like a ball which, now at Rome and now in London, seemed fated to remain perpetually in the air. The king thought he had been long enough the plaything of His Holiness and of the crafty cardinal. His patience was exhausted, and he resolved to show his adversaries that Henry VIII was more than a match for these bishops. We shall find him seizing this favorable opportunity, and giving an unexpected solution to the matter. Wolsey sorrowfully hung his head. By taking part with the nuncio and the pope, he had signed the warrant of his own destruction. So long as Henry had a single ray of hope, he thought proper still to dissemble with Clement VII, but he might vent all his anger on Wolsey. From the period of the Roman vacations, the cardinal was ruined in his master's mind. Wolsey's enemies, seeing his favor decline, hastened to attack him. Suffolk and Norfolk in particular, impatient to get rid of an insolent priest who had so long chafed their pride, told Henry that Wolsey had been continually playing false. They went over all his negotiations month by month and day by day, and drew the most overwhelming conclusions from them. Sir William Kingston and Lord Manners laid before the king one of the cardinal's letters which Sir Francis Bryan had obtained from the papal archives. In it the cardinal desired Clement to spin out the divorce question, and finally to oppose it, seeing, he added, that if Henry was separated from Catherine, a friend to the reformers would become Queen of England. This letter clearly expressed Wolsey's inmost thoughts. Rome at any price, and perish England and Henry rather than the Popedom. We can imagine the king's anger, and Bullen's friends were not working alone. There was not a person at court whom Wolsey's haughtiness and tyranny had not offended. No one in the king's council in whom his continual intrigues had not raised serious suspicions. He had, they said, betrayed in France the cause of England, kept up in time of peace and wore secret intelligence with Madame, mother of Francis I, received great presents from her, oppressed the nation, and trodden underfoot the laws of the kingdom. The people called him Frenchman and traitor, and all England seemed to vie in throwing burning brands at the superb edifice which the pride of this prelate had so laboriously erected. Wolsey was too clear-sighted not to discern the signs of his approaching fall. Both the rising and the setting sun, for thus an historian calls in Bullen and Catherine of Aragon, frowned upon him. And the sky, growing darker around him, gave token of the storm that was to overwhelm him. If the cause failed, Wolsey incurred the vengeance of the king. If it succeeded, he would be delivered up to the vengeance of the Bullens, without speaking of Catherine's, the emperor's, and the pope's. Happy Campeggio! Thought the cardinal, he has nothing to fear. If Henry's favor is withdrawn from him, Charles and Clement will make him compensation. But Wolsey lost everything when he lost the king's good graces. Detested by his fellow citizens, despised and hated by all Europe, he saw to whatever side he turned nothing but the just reward of his avarice and falseness. He strove in vain, as on other occasions, to lean on the ambassador of France. Du Bellay was solicited on the other side. "I am exposed here to such a heavy and continual fire that I am half dead," exclaimed the Bishop of Bayonne, and the cardinal met with an unusual reserve in his former confidant. Yet the crisis approached. Like a skillful but affrighted pilot, Wolsey cast his eyes around him to discover a port in which he could take refuge. He could find none but his See of York. He therefore began once more to complain of the fatigues of power, of the weariness of the diplomatic career, and to extol the sweetness of an episcopal life. On a sudden he felt a great interest about the flock of whom he had never thought before. Those around him shook their heads, well knowing that such a retreat would be to Wolsey the bitterest of disgraces. One single idea supported him. If he fell, it would be because he had clung more to the Pope than to the King. He would be the martyr of his faith. What a faith! What a martyr!